Welcome to the Fuller Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording at 1:22 p.m. That is Pacific Summer. Excuse me, it is Pacific Standard Time, and today is November 10th. And this is Friday, so it's the big picture, long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes. I thought this week I would start off and look at unemployment. And we can see in the US that it has been trending lower from a high of about 10% back at the end of 2008, and it's currently down to about 4.1%, and that is about as low as it has been since the year 2000, and that was a pretty significant low back there in 2000. We can also see that unemployment started ticking up just at the beginning of 2000. Last time we had a recession, it started ticking up again in 2007, and what we can see, for example, here is that unemployment is at least a coincident indicator. It's also a necessary indicator for recessions, and it's at 4.1% right now. It's not going to be updated again until the 8th of December, so it is something that we don't get updated, obviously, every day, but when it eventually starts to tick upwards again, well, then we have to start putting on our recession hat and thinking about what to do about it. And there is the possibility that it could in fact be one of the things that contributes to the next recession. I think that's something that we absolutely have to consider as a realistic possibility. Some of the other things that we think about as lead indicators for a recession are the inverted yield curve. But the inverted yield curve isn't an immediate prospect. In fact, with the rather significant move in treasuries that we had today, the yield curve has actually expanded again up to 74 basis points. It was up almost 4 full basis points today, but the trend is lower. And over the course of the next 18 months, we could see it moving into an inverted condition. The yield curve is generally and of course that is subject to the bond yield remaining relatively quiescent. If we see an uptick in inflation, or we see the Fed being forced to raise interest rates for some other reason, then that is going to obviously have an impact on this spread. But if situation remains such as it is, with a relatively inert environment, then the chances are that it's going to take some time for this to get to zero. The yield curve is a lead indicator for recessions for anything from about 6 to 18 months. So the fact that it is nowhere near zero right now suggests that this is not a flashing red signal. When we think about exactly then what could influence it, well, let's have a look at 10-year treasuries, because they had a pretty significant move in here today. They were up 6 basis points, but perhaps the more important point is that the yield has found support in the region of the trend mean over the last couple of weeks. It got all the way up towards that 2.5% level. It's back testing this 2.4% level right now, and that had been an area of resistance for a good half of this year. This is a clear upward dynamic, and upside follow through next week would then begin to suggest that we're back in a supply-dominated environment, and that the most likely scenario is that it goes at least back up towards 2.5%, and then potentially goes higher than that again. This looks like a bullish consolidation after a period of time where yields had, on average, been trending lower for almost 10 months. So we're in a rather different environment at the present moment. And part of the reason for that is because two-year yields continue to trend higher. They were up an additional couple of basis points in here today. They're at 1.65%. So there is, I think, increasing acceptance within the bond community that interest rates may begin to rise. If we look at the bond yield curve, and then what we and I've typed in the wrong ticker, so let me click on the right one. Then what we can see here is that the 3-month is at 1.22%, and the 1-year is at 1.5%. So when we look at this yield curve, it's still reasonably steep, but not particularly steep. Certainly it's not yet inverted. And when we think about what the potential is that inflationary pressures are rising. One of the reasons that bonds are potentially stronger in here right now is because of some of the things that Trump was saying in Asia. He has become much more protectionist, or more mercantilist might be a better way of describing it, that this America First policy, where he has clearly said that the US is not going to be entering into any additional multilateral agreements. Well, that has the potential to raise prices at home. And that would, of course, be inflationary. So there is certainly some impact from some of these speeches that are happening in Asia at present. And if we do have higher inflation, well, then that is going to necessitate higher interest rates. And if we have higher interest rates, well, the sector that's going to be most at risk from those is the high yield sector. And it was interesting that this week we saw the junk bond index pulling back. Now, it did pause in here today, but it is trading back below the trend mean, and the last time it did that was in late 2016. What we have seen over the course of this rebound from early 2016 onwards has been that every time it has pulled back to the region of the trend mean, it has bounced in a pretty emphatic manner. If that pattern is going to persist, well, then it is going to have to follow through on the upside next week, and most particularly then find support. I think extend its move back above the trend mean. So if it fails to do that, well, then we would really have to be asking questions about whether this isn't a completed top formation, and and since it has a loss of momentum, some failed upside breaks, that it has type 2 top formation characteristics. If it sustains a move back below 36.50, then the potential is that we could have a massive reaction against the prevailing trend. There is there, and considering that, and of course this is a treasury market, excuse me, this is treasury market volatility. So when we look at that, it has been coming down and actually moved to a new low in here this week, and it was a little bit higher yesterday, but bond market volatility has been at record lows. And generally speaking, when we think about the potential in terms of volatility, generally speaking, more volatile periods follow periods of less volatility. And one of the things that has contained this volatility, not just in the bond markets, but obviously also in the equity markets, has been the fact that interest rates have been incredibly low, and that access to liquidity has been easy, and that there has been abundant liquidity. Well, the VIX index was a little bit firmer in here this week. A point that I've made on a number of previous broadcasts is that because the average level of the VIX has been so low, that it has become progressively more sensitive to moves in the stock market. So while the stock market itself hasn't moved at all, really, the VIX has, and it's up almost, well, if we think about it in terms of percents, it's not particularly useful because it was at 9.5. At the beginning of this week, and it's at 11 and a third right now. So then you could be talking about moves in the region of about 15%. But the more important point is that it has been a while since we've seen a higher high. That was the most recent higher high was back in August, and since then we've had volatility contracting. With the move such as we've had in the junk bond index, and indeed with the high yield market, and I'm looking at the Barclays high yield spread index when I talk about that, but it failed to sustain the breakdown this week. It is now back testing the region of the trend mean, and we can also see quite clearly that When bond yields start to trend higher, and most particularly, excuse me, when I say I meant to say bond spreads, when high yield bond spreads start to trend higher, then it spells trouble. And we are at very low levels, and the quantity of leverage has been increasing progressively over the course of the last 10 years. So it is now, it is, we've been through an incredibly consistent period in terms of stock markets since the end of last year. And in that time, bond spreads have not done really much of anything at all. They certainly haven't represented a headwind, but eventually this is going to break higher and it is going to begin to trend. And that might not necessarily represent a problem immediately, but the higher bond spreads go, then the greater the likelihood is that highly leveraged companies are going to have difficulty refinancing. And it is the refinance is when you tend to get these problems arising. Most companies don't have much difficulty paying off the coupons, and they can keep doing that. They can service the debt. But when it comes back to repaying the principal in the high yield sector, they primarily rely on refinancing. And if that refinancing is occurring at much higher levels, well, then that is going to represent an issue if they can't refinance at attractive rates. There are two, I think, rather big points here. In the retail sector, you can see, for example, that Bon-Ton Stores has 70 billion in debt, Sears has 28, but Macy's has 33 and Kohl's has 34. Bon-Ton and Sears are distressed rating. They've got C ratings. JCPenney has got 46 billion and it's a B rated, whereas Macy's is still BAA, which is the upper side of the high yield sector. And what I find interesting is that there is obviously a problem in the retail sector. Companies like Macy's do have online presences, but they're not particularly effective. But what I find quite interesting this week is that Macy's posted an upside Q reversal on a weekly basis. And if it can follow through on the upside next week, well, then that will challenge the progression of lower rally highs, and it could set us up for the next rally. We are entering the most favorable time of the year for the retail sector. If they can't make money in December, in January, excuse me, in November and December, then they're just not going to make it for the year. This is when they make back all their costs for the year. And in fact, if we look at Macy's earnings, it's always the first quarter of the year where you get these pops on the upside in terms of their earnings. So this is about the best time of the year for the share, and it is now posting an upside weekly Q reversal. That doesn't mean that it is out of the woods. There's no visibility on a recovery strategy, but it is way oversold. So we could have the potential for a recovery rally. One thing that I think is really worth considering here is when you look at the kinds of jobs that are most likely to be lost as a result of automation. And I've seen lots of reports saying that people in technical work and people in the banking industry are going to be displaced by robots, and they might well be, but the low-hanging fruit are in the low-paid occupations, are and most particularly in the low-skill occupations, and that falls most particularly into retail and indeed into hauling stuff around. So we've already seen that Waymo this week has brought out their first completely driverless car, and they are now testing that. And that represents a rather profound change, because it's only a matter of time. We still obviously don't know how long it's going to take them to deliver on autonomous vehicles that are as capable, if not more capable, than a human being in all road conditions. But they are rapidly getting up to a pace where they're going to be competitive, at least in a city environment, where speeds are generally somewhat slower, and the rules of the road are probably better adopted because of the weight of traffic. More traffic probably is an advantage for autonomous vehicles because there's less likelihood that a deer is going to jump out in front of the car. When we think about these types of changes, these are long-term potential outcomes, and they're most likely to affect the right-hand side of this chart, where you have low skill and reasonably low pay. These represent the low-hanging fruit for the technology sector. It's a lot more difficult to displace someone who's highly skilled. It doesn't mean that it's not impossible, but what we can also see about on this chart is that when you look at the right-hand side, that there are a lot of jobs that are skewed in the $20,000 to $40,000 per year level, where you have low skills. So low skills tend to bunch around those types of payments, whereas in the highly skilled sector, you have a great deal of dispersion over on the left-hand side. So when we think about that, that also points towards the potential that the low-paid people are going to be the ones that are automated first. And that also contributes to the reason why we should be looking at unemployment, because what happens in retail is probably going to be very important about how the next problem evolves in the economy. Because what we have is technological innovation that is really advancing at a very rapid pace. We've had an enormous amount of leverage that has been taken on, and a good deal of that is in either commercial property or in retail. And private equity taking out large amounts of debt after acquiring retail operations is almost the nexus of where that potential problem could be. And then we have the fact that we're entering a period of time where interest rates are beginning to rise. So that can then be the catalyst. And we know that the Fed has killed off more bull markets than any other factor combined. So this is, I think, something that we really should be paying attention to, because it is one of the things we talk about at the chart seminar, and I'm really looking forward to heading over to London, and I'll be flying on Monday. I'll be arriving Tuesday early afternoon, so I don't anticipate a break in service, but recording and posting might be a little bit, I think, jerky on Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday, because I'm in meetings and then teaching the chart seminar. So but I don't anticipate that there's going to be a break in service. But one of the things that we teach at the chart seminar is to think about myopia. And there are two ways that you can think about myopia. One is that when you buy something, you obviously have more of a bias towards whatever it is you've bought, and you are more interested in what's in your portfolio than what's not in it. And that is something that is really worth considering, because regardless of what you own, there are a number of factors that are worth monitoring for signs of trouble, because they are represent the canaries in the coal mine in terms of the liquidity situation. And by and large, the credit market tends to lead the stock market, and we know there's a lot of leverage in the credit markets. So we should be watching the unemployment rate, and we should be watching the high yield spreads, just because those are representative of where pressure could come to bear on a significant proportion of the stock market. But then, what are the other things that can contribute to a recession? Well, one of those is oil prices. And surging oil prices contribute to recessions because the price of oil represents a rather significant, I don't know what I've just brought up, so let me do that again. When we look at oil prices on a long-term basis, they spiked higher from about 2007 onwards, and that was a precipitating event before we had the big pullback in response to the recession. Well, oil prices are not yet, or certainly not at present, surging higher, but they are trending higher, and the price has now surmounted the $60 level, and that is certainly in the interests of Saudi Arabia, considering that they want to IPO Saudi Aramco. But they're looking at the what's happening with autonomous vehicles. They're looking what's happening with the lithium sector, or indeed the production of batteries. And the battery super cycle is occurring independently of what happens with regard to Tesla. Tesla is a B minus rated credit. It falls very squarely into that high yield sector, and it has benefited enormously, rising from lows back in 2010 of $15 to currently $300, closer to $400 just a few months ago. And it has achieved all of that on the back of access to abundant liquidity. And it is reasonable to say that that is going to persist for as long as it takes. Either they race ahead and meet their production targets, which would vindicate the decision of their investors, or they fail and access to cheap liquidity evaporates as interest rates rise. Well, if that occurs, then the potential is that Tesla could disappear. And certainly that isn't something that I say lightly, but it has some significant assets, and one of those is its battery factory, because it has demonstrated that it can achieve scale, that there is a market for scaling up battery production, and the number of copycats out there is increasing rapidly, and there is a race on to not only build the manufacturing capacity, but to secure the resources to feed those plants. So there is a supply and elasticity bull market currently ongoing in lithium, because it takes time to get that lithium capacity up to scratch. Orocobre represents what I would consider a pure play, that it is that its Olaroz project is on the way to completely eclipsing its borax operations, and it has broken up in a way out of this almost 18-month range just in the last couple of weeks. There's a great deal of copper in lithium-ion batteries, and there's also a great deal of nickel and cobalt. Well, cobalt is often found with nickel, and most cobalt comes from the Democratic Republic of Congo, which is not particularly secure. But perhaps the more important point is that nickel has was a bit weaker this week, but the most important thing it's done is break up and out of this 2-year base formation. Nickel has been the wallflower compared to the industrial metals. There are, I think, two points that are worth considering. One is that we're still in a period of synchronized global economic expansion, and the reason that I run through what the potential threats are is because those are things we need to keep at the back of our minds. Those are things we should probably look at once a week. But in the meantime, we are still in a period of synchronized global economic expansion, and when economies are firing on all cylinders, then that should help to create demand for industrial resources. So that's what we started to see from the beginning of 2016, and it has continued this year following a hiatus at the beginning of 2017. And generally speaking, the industrial resources sector tends to be one of the sectors that peaks last and is one of the sectors that has the greatest potential to play catch up with the impressive performance we see in stock markets. And we certainly have impressive performance on stock markets. The S&P 500, for example, has been trending in a very consistent manner all of this year. And the pace of the advance has moderated over the last 3 weeks, but it is still going up nonetheless, and the progression of higher reaction lows remains intact. It has been pausing below the 2600 level. And the fact that it was in mildly negative territory today, but off its lows, and when we go back and remember what happened with the volatility index, that it has gone up more than the stock market has come down. That also helps to illustrate how much more sensitive the volatility index is to really very small moves in the stock market. A 2-point decline on the S&P 500 is really a risible kind of decline to really move the volatility index, and yet that is what is happening. When we look at this market, and not simply on a daily basis but on a weekly basis, we can see clearly that the market is now somewhat overextended relative to the trend mean. Certainly not exaggerated relative to previous overextensions, particularly back in 2010 and 2011, or even in 2014. But it is overextended. It is due some pause in consolidation. And if it gets some pause in consolidation, well, then that would be really quite healthy. But there is the possibility that it doesn't, and that the pace of the advance picks up. Now, one of the things that is worth considering is that when we think about what is the potential here, if it accelerates higher, what that would probably be accompanied by would be more enthusiasm about economic growth. And I think at right now, that's going to be tied to what happens in terms of the tax cuts that have been promised by the Trump administration. There is still a lot of horse trading going on, and there's only about 2 weeks before the Thanksgiving recess, so they do want to get it passed by then so that it's in law books by the 1st of January. And that means that there are going to have to be some very big decisions made, and then some an enormous effort put underway to ensure that they can in fact pass it. If they fail to pass it, well, then we're going to get at least a mean reversion on the stock market. If they do in fact pass it, and then it will be a question of what measures are kept in and what measures aren't. But corporate taxes are a big issue for the stock market, and tax cuts for consumers are obviously a big factor for the US economy, since it is almost completely consumer dominated. That would suggest that there is the potential for an uptick in volatility over the next few weeks. But by and large, this is still a bullish environment, and there is very little to question that this isn't going to persist. And there is the realistic possibility that it could accelerate higher. One of the animating factors behind the fact that the market has been rising so very consistently with an almost complete absence of volatility over the last year has been the prevalence of quantitative strategies and risk parity strategies, which in many respects are valuation agnostic. Now, if they're valuation agnostic, that is comparable to is what we saw back in the 1990s, which was that earnings don't matter. And from the perspective of these types of strategies, earnings don't matter, because what they are influenced by is flow. And as long as volatility remains low, and as long as you don't have volatility in either bonds or equities, then what that does is it allows them to increase the size of their positions. And if they're increasing the size of their positions, and then that is going to contribute to higher prices. What would eventually upset the apple cart would be if we start to see higher interest rates, and if that contributes to more volatility in the bond market, because what that would then start to influence would be the relationship between the two markets. And then that would have a knock-on effect with volatility in the equity markets. So again, what we can anticipate is that credit is going to lead the stock market. And it is something that we really have to pay attention to. But there is the possibility that the market can accelerate higher. What we have certainly seen is that Nvidia is accelerating higher. It has done incredibly well over the last few months. It is now $64 overextended relative to the trend mean on a $216 share. The PE has drifted higher from about 22 to over 50 in the last year. And of course, the bulls will go back and look at back in 2000, the PE was at 100. But it's really not that long ago the PE was less than 20. And this is an awfully big move that we've already seen. We can also see that the PE around 60 has been an area of resistance from all the way back in the early 2000s. So we know that this market is getting progressively hotter. But again, there is no indication yet that the advance has stopped. And because we're in a low volatility environment, there isn't a great deal of aggressive selling pressure into these momentum moves. In fact, because of the quantitative nature of the strategies that are represent quite a considerable proportion of the trading, that because they're following flow, that they contribute to acceleration in popular themes, and they also contribute. Then, what is an additional point is that the complete dominance of ETFs has created passive investing, and passive investing is also valuation agnostic. So, if you're investing in the index and you buy the index because you think it's going to go higher, and the index is made up of, for example, the Russell is made up of 2,000 companies. 500 of those are probably going to be pretty suspect. But you buy the index, so you're buying good companies, you're buying bad companies, and you're buying mediocre companies. And because the relative performance of the good companies outweighs the bad companies, that encourages flow, and flow in begets additional upside, so then you get an impressive bull market. And the Russell has not been as consistent on the upside over the last few years as the S&P 500, and partly because of the issues with liquidity in smaller companies, but also because buying the index you're getting a lot of garbage along with the better companies. Eventually, indexing and this way of investing that is agnostic to valuation is probably going to contribute to some issues, because eventually there are going to be a lot of companies in that the index is not, the performance of the index will not truly reflect the fundamental valuations of the constituents of those indices. And then you get an issue. So monitoring the breadth of indices is probably also something that is worth considering. And also, when we think about the impact that technology is having, well, we know that that is creating polarization, because there are obviously clear winners and losers. Macy's has is now a fraction of where it was before, and Amazon has rocketed through $1,000 in just the last few weeks. It is going in almost the exact opposite direction. And when we think about the big picture
and the long term. I think that when we think about who are the primary beneficiaries of the period of disinflation that we had all the way from the early 1980s, then it's primarily the baby boomers, or the people that are now beginning to retire. They were the ones that benefited most from asset price inflation, because they were able to buy houses and start pension plans before you had massive appreciation in stock and stock prices, bond prices, and in real estate. The Nikkei this month has broken above the psychological 20,000 level, and it's the first time it has been able to get to these levels since 1994. It paused in here this week, and we have had an uptick in volatility. And that was an outside day yesterday. We didn't get much downside follow-through in here today, but the market was down about 187 points. When we look at the volatility on the Japanese index, then it has been pushing upwards, but it was not able to hold its lows, and it was down a point and a quarter in here today. Perhaps the more important point about Japan is that rather than thinking about when is the most opportune time to participate on a short-term basis, the chances are that Japan is going to be a buy on the dips for the foreseeable future. That if it can sustain the move above 20,000, then we can conclude that we're back in a secular bull market. And Japan is currently running easy monetary and fiscal policy simultaneously, and it's the only major economy doing that. And they are going for outright inflation. What you have in Japan is you have a lot of older people, and they're going down the route of automation, and they have been forced to become more efficient, so that right now they're looking at labor shortages because their economy is doing better. They singularly failed to stoke inflation after the crash in their property and stock markets in the early 1990s. But of course, they were trying to do that during one of the greatest disinflationary periods in history. And there is the realistic possibility that we're now moving into a more inflationary period. And part of the reason that we might conclude that is because we have such an enormous amount of leverage in the market, and that credit worthiness is going to become more of an issue, and that access to liquidity will be more of an issue, and that will contribute to a tighter environment. And if we do move out of I think the animating factors behind the period of disinflation was the rise of globalization, the progressively closer integration of the global economy, which created global supply chains, and then the outsourcing of jobs from the developed world to the emerging markets to lower costs. If we are in fact moving out of that, then that is going to have an inflationary outcome. And that is something that is potentially now being signaled by the uptick in performance of Japanese equities. They are certainly trading on a discount in terms of valuations relative to both Europe and to the USA, and most particularly relative to the USA. But I think one of the other things that we should consider is that Japan is probably the country least likely to experience generation wars, because the number of young people relative to the number of old people is so small. Then it is really down to governance as to whether we're going to have generation wars in other countries. Because in India, they have a vast number of young people. And classically, that is regarded as the demographic dividend. The Nifty index is continuing to sustain the move above 10,000. When we look at the rupee and perhaps look at it on the long term, then what we're presented with was a currency that did nothing but go down for what feels like an awfully long time. And when we look at that on a logarithmic scale chart, then we get to see some color. Because the most important thing the rupee has done in almost 30 years was to break its progression of lower rally highs back in March. Now we're getting the first step above this base, and as long as it is holding the region of a 0.15, then the potential is that we've seen the lows, that there is the realistic possibility that the rupee's downtrend has ended. That doesn't necessarily mean it's in a new bull market, but that the likelihood is that the risk attached to investing in India from a currency perspective has deteriorated because they have begun to get their inflationary problems under control. Now, the uptick in energy prices is a short-term consideration from India's perspective, and it has the potential to offer a headwind over the medium term if what's happening in Saudi Arabia has not just short-term but medium-term ramifications. Because India is a country where governance is, I think, undeniably improving. That you have had the rollout of 4G, which was privately led. Then you have the introduction of the GST, which has helped to standardize tax rates between the various states in India. You've had biometric data acquired from every single person in the country, which is no small feat considering they have a population of over 1 billion people. And coupled with the rollout of 4G, it means that for the hundreds of millions of illiterate people, they now have access to the internet via their phones, that they can access websites and services with their voices, so they don't need to type in passwords, and they can access websites with their biometric data. And that means that India has now opened up their economy to hundreds of millions of new people, and that represents a profound change. But most importantly, from a long-term perspective, it's evidence of governance improving. And if governance is improving, then generally speaking, you might have fits and starts in the stock market, but over the long term, you get asset price appreciation. And that means that if governance is improving, India is less likely to have a generation war. And not least because there are significant number of younger people, but they don't have a lot of older people that they're going to have to support. But it's somewhat different in the Middle East. And if we look most specifically at Saudi Arabia, half of the population is less than 25. And that 12.5 million people have very little chance of experiencing the kind of standard of living that their parents would have enjoyed, because the fount of liquidity and capital flowing from oil production has begun to deteriorate, and the number of people ask with their hands out has increased beyond recognition over the last 30 years. So that has contributed now to a rather difficult situation. They have no choice but to do something, or what they're going to end up with is massive civil insurrection. One of the reasons that you had the Arab Spring in a few years ago, and one of the reasons it kicked off in Tanzania, excuse me, it wasn't, it was in Tunisia, excuse me, that was because they had such a surfeit of young people and the price of bread was rising. Well, the price of bread rising in Saudi Arabia may not be a catalytic event, but the fact that there are such huge numbers of unemployed people with very little prospect of employment, and more importantly, that they don't want to work because their parents never really worked. And that is something that is going to represent a rather profound change. The fact that the country has 8 million guest workers, and that what is going to happen to them is another big question. So they have to go for reform. One of the things that can certainly help to instill a national spirit is war. And Saudi Arabia is fighting proxy wars in Yemen, Iraq, Syria, and is potentially gearing up to start another one in Lebanon. They fear encirclement by Iran, and there is the possibility that they go for open conflagration. Of course, what that would also do is push up the oil price, and even the threat of an outright war would push up the oil price, and would also then burnish the valuation of Saudi Aramco. We have to at least bear in mind that there is the potential that everything that is going on right now in Saudi Arabia is an effort to push up the oil price so that they can get the best price possible for their IPO. That might be incredibly cynical, but unfortunately, there is we have to at least consider the possibility that it's realistic. Then, that is one of the questions that is outstanding, that there is the possibility that we're going to get generation wars. And the very fact that you have that possibility is contributing to this uptick in tensions. And we're also seeing that to a certain extent in the UK, because it was primarily the older generation voted for Brexit, and the younger generation voted to stay in the EU. The older generation are the people who own homes, and the younger generation are renting. The older generation have got pensions, and the younger generation don't believe they'll ever have a pension. And these are really quite profound problems, because the younger generation, in almost an act of rebellion, are voting for Labour, which is contributing to which, if one actually reads the manifesto, does not stand up for property rights. In just in that alone represents a decline in the standards of governance. But what we've also seen is that the political environment, which has been built on this support for globalization, on the basis of that of almost guilt from the colonial times, from the potential to make profits from it, because wage you pick up the spread in wages by moving offshore, from the benefits to trade from low taxes, and that the majority of people were benefiting because of the low cost of imports, and that on aggregate, when rather than thinking about people as individuals, what statisticians tend to think of is numbers. And if the measure benefits 51% of people, well, then it's probably worth doing. Now, that might be an exaggeration, but the problem is that 30 years ago, when globalization really started to take off, it was a comparatively small number of people were being impacted. Whereas today, it is progressively more regions are being impacted either by the fact that their jobs have gone or that they're being outcompeted by the cost of cheap imports, that it is creating revolutionary environments. Because politicians and the political parties that have benefited most in the last 30 years, they have become conditioned by their set of policies that they have proposed year in, year out, election after election, just tweaking around the edges. But the problem is that the number of people that those policies are working for has declined, and the people for whom those policies are not working has increased. And that is why we are getting this uptick in nationalism, xenophobia, where some people are looking at it as independence movements or anti-immigration. But if we take a step back and rather, instead of looking at each of these countries, whether it is the UK, Scotland, Catalonia, and Spain, the Five Star Movement, and the north and south of Italy, Hungary, the Czech Republic, Poland, Turkey, Saudi Arabia, if you look at the USA, then it isn't simply nationalism or xenophobia. It is a wholesale, I think, reaction against the status quo. And because there is this dearth of leadership, there is a dearth of politicians that have the capacity to come up with an idea that will deliver higher standards of living for people who have not seen their standard of living rise in upwards of 20 years, then that suggests that the polarization in the political sector is going to persist, and that elections are going to become even more polarized. That we are not only, we're not really at the end of this polarization in the political process. We're probably closer to the beginning, because we have not yet had the kinds of governments elected that are willing to propose radical agendas to create better standards of living for their own people. The fact that, for example, in the UK, that the UK moved from being an energy exporter to being an energy importer about a decade ago, and the fact that that has contributed to a higher cost of living for people, and that it represents a draw on the country's finances year in, year out, and that no substantive policy for energy independence has been created, is testament to the fact that the political situation is ossified and that it needs to change. The problem is that when you get these kinds of changes, that it can break and change in radical ways that are not anticipated or indeed wanted by the majority, or and most particularly by the people who have benefited most from the status quo, who are in the political, financial, and media. Those are the people that generally benefit most from the status quo in any society. So when the status quo changes, they are the ones that are most likely to be resistant to that change, and that's exactly what we're seeing. But the answer is inflation. That has always been the answer, that if people feel like they're not getting enough of money, then what they want is higher wages. They don't care that if everybody gets higher wages, that is going to create an inflationary problem, and they may eventually end off worse off than they are right now. That kind of nuance is probably overly complicated for the vast majority of people. And what that suggests is that what we're going to see is wage demands beginning to rise. And that is inflationary. Excuse me. So, if we do in fact get wages continuing to advance, and they did pull back at the last reading, and that is probably another factor why the stock market has been pushing higher. But one thing I know about this index is that it is updated and then restated from previous months. So I don't think it is the most reliable of indices because I can't simply download the most recent point, but rather I have to refresh the entire history because they are constantly revising their figures. But interest, or excuse me, wages have been trending higher since 2015. And they may stop trending higher when with the fact that more people are coming out of the or I guess the participation rate is starting to trend higher as well. So that could keep a lid on wages. But what we see from indications are that if bond yields are rising and the Japanese equity market has broken out and the rise of populism or indeed reaction to the status quo, which I think is the most correct way to think about it, then that is going to contribute to higher wages. And those higher wages will be delivered either by regulatory change, which will necessitate higher wages, or the market forces will dictate that we will need to have them, that if we will either have a complete pushback on globalization, which will force repatriation of manufacturing capacity and push up prices considerably, which will then contribute to inflation and then necessarily wage demands to compensate for that, or it will happen in another way. But the likelihood is that if we continue to have the build up of reactionary forces in the political sphere, then the answer will eventually be inflation. And it is worth considering that one of the best hedges against inflation is the stock market. So if we look at not simply look at the last 10 years, but if we look at the last century, well, we know that the stock market can go sideways for an awfully long time, and then it trends higher for a long time. So what we've had is these lengthy periods where the stock market has gone sideways and then it trends higher in a very lengthy manner for the lengthy medium term. And these secular bull markets can be punctuated by recessions. They can be punctuated by pullbacks, and those pullbacks can be violent. But because we have these very powerful factors, that we have technological innovation that is affecting the energy market, and it's affecting the healthcare market most particularly, and of course we're also getting it in consumer goods. But if we get innovation in energy and healthcare, then those both contribute to productivity gains, because productivity gains in energy contribute to lower costs for getting stuff done. And if we have innovation in healthcare, people can live longer, healthier lives and therefore work longer, and they become more personally productive. If those are delivered, then we have the potential for additional upside as value is created by more people. But then, of course, we also have more people, and the global population is likely to accelerate higher over the next couple of decades and add an additional 3 billion people. So that is also going to contribute to economic growth simply by headcount. And most particularly, if we get improving standards of governance in the primary population centers of the world, which are currently in Asia and increasingly in Africa, that will also contribute to a secular bull market. And those are very important facts, that the rise of the global consumer is a major consideration from the perspective of the long-term investor. That when we think about this index on the very long term, then we have the potential here that certainly it is a bit overbought in the short term, that there's probably going to be a recession at some point in the next few years, but that if we think about the very long term, that it could be a decade or more before we see an important peak in the stock market and the next very big issue that we need to be worried about, the end of a secular bull market, the onset of the next secular range, which could last for anything from 12 to 20 years. We're just nowhere near that kind of range right now. So that suggests that, yes, obviously we have to be cautious about what happens in terms of stock markets and in terms of the economy and when the next recession is going to be. But we also have to realize that the next recession is going to provide us with a wonderful buying opportunity, and that those are things we need to bear in mind when the whole world is saying that that we've seen the end of the financial markets as we know it, then that's not something that's likely to be true. So I think with that, I will leave you for the weekend. I'll wish all the best to all of you.